I call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee to order. And members, the first order of business we have is to move the minutes for February 4th. We do have a quorum present. So do I have somebody who will move the minutes for February 4th? Representative Albright moves the minutes for February 4th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, the first bill we have up is House File 346, Representative Hoppe's bill. And we are actually going to be moving this fairly quickly, members. It mostly has to do with financing. There's not a whole lot of policy in it, but we will have Representative Hoppe introduce the bill, and we'll move from there. Representative Hoppe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 346 is the HCMC State Poison Center bill. And I'm not exactly sure what I did wrong, but somehow it got referred to this committee, and I apologize for taking up your time. I think it appropriately should have been referred to HHS Finance. And so that's what we're hoping to do today is move it on to that committee.
And do we have someone who wants to testify here, Representative Hoppe?
We have someone here to answer questions if I get in any trouble.
Okay, members, are there any questions for Representative Hoppe or his testifier? Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I just feel like we shouldn't vote on a bill without at least kind of getting some little bit of a chance to look at it and see. So let me just ask, is this pretty much just what the poison centers are already doing, and it's just funding to, I mean, could you just give us a second of what you're looking for the money for?
Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, yes. We're not changing any policy. We're looking for money here, $800,000 in one-time money. There has been a reduction in federal money, and for several years now, HCMC has been funding this out of the goodness of their hearts, even though it covers everywhere in the state. And they're just looking for a little bit of money to try to help with their budget, and they want to continue running this just as normal. And now we'll have somebody testify to anything I got wrong.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Godfrey with Hennepin County Medical Center, and Representative Hoppe's description is correct. HCMC does subsidize this program of about up to $700,000 a year. Our CEO said that we'll no longer be able to do that as of July 1st, so we'll need to start cutting back on services that we provide through the center. $100,000 also goes to restore some public education and outreach activities that we have done in the past, but have no longer been able to do so because of our budget situation, and also restore some research capabilities that we've had at the center.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling and members. Last year, the Hennepin County Medical Center, the Poison Center, answered calls from every one of our 87 counties, close to 50,000 calls. They are truly a statewide asset, and all we're looking to do is preserve that asset and let them keep doing the good work they've been doing.
Okay, members, any further questions? Okay, seeing none, I will move that House File 346 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, members, the next bill we have up is House File 161, which establishes the ABLE Act in Minnesota, being authored by Representative Zerwas. So, Representative Zerwas, I will have you move your bill and also give an introduction to the lovely treats it looks like you brought, which would only be suiting for you. So, Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'll move House File 161 to be passed and referred to civil law.
Representative Zerwas moves that House File 161 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Zerwas.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. The ABLE bill, it would be state enacting language for federal law that was passed December 19th of 2014 that allows for families that have disabled individuals that are under the age of 26 to establish a savings account similar to a 529 college savings plan, but these plans would be to do long-term expenses with housing, health care, and education for individuals with SSI qualified disabilities or blindness. And to talk more specifically about the bill and implementation is Mr. Larson from ARC.
And Representative Zerwas, just before we move to the testifier, I understand we have a DE1 amendment just to get the bill in the shape that you would like it. So if you want to move the DE1 amendment.
You are correct, Madam Chair. I will move the DE1.
Okay, members, Representative Zerwas is moving the DE1 amendment. And Representative Zerwas, you just want to give a little explanation as to what we're doing with the DE1, and then if members have any questions.
Yep, the DE1 is what passed out of committee in the Senate, and it's working to clarify a little bit. This is a little bit in progress as we're trying to get some answers, some questions answered around implementation as far as whether it should be DHS or MMB. And Mr. Larson can answer more specific questions about the hoops that we're jumping through to try to get this implemented with, at this point, some limited information from our federal partners.
Okay. Members, we will get the bill in the shape that the author would like. So with that, Representative Zerwas renews the motion to adopt the DE1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. With that, let's go to Mr. Larson. If you could introduce yourself and speak to the bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota, and I'm here speaking in support of the ABLE bill. And thank you for Representative Zerwas and bringing it to the committee. In the disability community, we're really excited in 2015. Not only do we have the ABLE Act, which we'll be reviewing today, which will help individuals with disabilities to save for expenses that can't be met in other ways, but also we will, during the 2015 legislative session, be working on increasing the MA income and asset limit. So the combination of these two items, if we make progress on them this year, will be a tremendous boost to getting individuals with disabilities a step out of poverty. In Minnesota, over 100,000 individuals with disabilities and their families depend on a wide variety of public health benefits for income, health care, food, and housing assistance. Eligibility for these public benefits, such as SSI, SNAP, Medicaid, and Medicaid, require meeting a means or resource test that limits eligibility to individuals to report more than $2,000 in cash savings, retirement funds, and other items of significant value. To remain eligible for these public benefits, an individual must remain poor. For the first time in public policy, the ABLE Act recognizes the extra and significant costs of living with a disability. These include costs related to raising a child with significant disabilities, or a working age adult with disabilities for accessible housing, transportation, personal assistance services, assistive technology, and health care not covered by insurance, Medicaid, medical assistance, or Medicare. ABLE accounts will be tax advantaged savings accounts for individuals with disabilities and their families. Contributions to the account made by any person, the account beneficiary, family, or friends would not be tax deductible. Each state is responsible for establishing and operating an ABLE program, and that's why we're here today. But first, the Secretary of the Department of Treasury will begin to develop regulations that will guide the states in terms of the information required to be presented to open an ABLE account, the documentation needed to meet the requirements of the ABLE account eligibility for a person with a disability, and the definition of details of qualified disability expenses and the documentation that will be needed for tax reporting. Each individual will be allowed to accept or invest in their account up to $14,000 per year to a total amount of $100,000. Beyond that, then, your SSI would be at risk. And with that, I want to thank the committee for hearing this bill, but this gives a chance for families to provide more choice and control over the resources that are available to them and meet expenses that aren't met under our current existing system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And before we proceed any further, being as it is Zerwas Day here in the Health and Human Services Reform Committee, Representative Schumacher, I believe you need to pass the treats around the table that Representative Zerwas left down there. They're just hovering down there. Okay, that's taken care of. Members.
Madam Chair, my
Representative Zerwas.
My plan was to have everyone's mouths full of candy by the time it came to ask questions.
I had a feeling.
So if we could get those moving.
Okay, members, are there any questions or comments to Representative Zerwas's bill? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm pleased to be a co-author on this, and I think it's a good move forward, but we're all still trying to learn and understand how this quite works. And the one question I had was on, there's an authority, the account owner, who I assume is the person with the disability that is the beneficiary, and yet under 6.22, they can change the beneficiary to a member of the family, but only if the person to whom it's transferred is also disabled. And I just was, I'm having a hard time kind of envisioning how that might work if you had a family. Could this be transferred to another adult since this is really designed for children, to an adult with a disability? Or, you know, Mr. Larson, do you have a sense of what's envisioned there?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, this is actually for persons with disabilities of any age. There is a requirement that the disability had to be present before the age of 26. And I think the particular section, and we're still getting familiar with this bill ourselves, just means that, let's say a person was going to get up to the $100,000 limit and they had a brother or sister they could transfer the money to. I think it's permissive to do that type of thing. But we can look into that further and get back to you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just think that we just need to understand how, you know, all these pieces fit together with, you know, disability eligibility and those sorts of things. And I just was trying to envision the circumstance. Thank you.
Question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas? I have two questions for you, Representative. On line 3.20 discusses rollover distributions. And I'm just wondering, in the context of the maximum limit for which an individual can own an account, does the rollover opportunity apply, or would it be denied if it would be pertaining to the max cap on ownership of a ABLE account?
Representative Zerwas.
You know, Mr. Representative Albright, I'm not sure. I'd have to look into that more. I'm not sure what that rollover cap would be if it has to do with the max amount accrued. I'm wondering if maybe that might be a better question for House Research.
Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair and Representatives, I don't know the answer to that either.
No problem. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas, on line 3.28, it speaks about a particular date on which the fair market value of the account will be assessed. What date is that?
Representative Zerwas.
Representative Albright, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, is that the maturity date that they're talking about?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas, I don't believe so. I believe it's the date upon which the assessment for the maximum value of the account attributable to an individual owner is made with respect to additional contributions.
So that would be the cap date.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, that would be the cap date then.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, is it end of calendar year? Is it the date of birth for the individual? In 529 parlance vernacular, you have to choose. So is it the end of calendar year upon which the assessed value is made for contemplation of future contributions or rollovers? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I don't know which date is specified, but that's something that we can certainly clarify before civil law.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one final question on page 5, lines 5.6 and 5.7. I know that the language here is fairly explicit, but I think it should be made part of the public record that the administration or the commissioner can delegate these responsibilities to an outside third-party administrator for purposes of adjudicating the claims and also, in my opinion, probably making a better sense of the program for participants than possibly an agency might. Is that your understanding as well?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yeah, like we had discussed earlier today, I think there are multiple options that the federal law allows for the state enabling language to either have an agency implementation or a third-party private implementation. This is our first whack at it, as it were. This is the second round of language. First draft, we had some MMB involvement with DHS. DHS is a little concerned whether or not this is the right place for them to land. This is brand new. Our big concern is making sure now that federal law allows for this state enabling language, we're trying to get this out and available to families this session. This might take a few iterations yet this session, but I'm sure by the time we get done with this, we'll have a program that's ready for Minnesota families.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, any other questions? Okay. Seeing no questions, Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 161, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And on to your next bill, which is House File 513, establishing a stroke transport protocol. Representative Zerwas, you want to move your bill?
I will move House File 513. I believe the next step is the General Register, Madam Chair.
Okay, members, Representative Zerwas moves that his bill be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
I have an A1 amendment, Madam Chair, to get the bill in the shape in which I'd like to deal with it.
Okay, Representative Zerwas moves the A1 amendment to get the shape which the author would like it. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, House File 513 is an implementation step for the statewide stroke system of care. It involves the implementation of the program, and it needs to be passed in order for the program that's been in development the last several years to get going. As you all know, stroke is a time-sensitive and time-critical condition when it occurs. And as we've discussed in committee before, someone that has an acute neurologic event within the metro area has outcomes generally far better than if the event were to occur in greater Minnesota. Through the work already done in the previous years through the statewide stroke system, we now have 67 designated stroke hospitals throughout Minnesota. This was critical to utilize rural hospitals as a part of the treatment system and plan. And now this bill will help update protocols for EMS providers to allow the most fluid treatment of this sudden condition. And I'll turn it over. I think Buck is going to talk about the EMS portion.
Mr. McAlpin.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin of the Minnesota Ambulance Association and representing the Minnesota Chapter of Emergency Physicians. We've vetted this out with our associations, both of them. Currently in Minnesota, the majority of our ambulance systems already operate with some type of protocol. So we applaud Representative Zerwas on working with Justin over at the American Heart Association. The more we do to standardize this, like a lot of legislation we had in here last week, to align some of how we track this and make sure our outcomes are where we want them to be, fits in line with something that we would support and appreciate your support.
Okay, members, questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and either to the author or maybe it's to the Department of Health. I'm just trying to understand with the amendment who it is that's actually setting up these protocols. And as the bill was originally drafted, it was EMS programs, and now as it's amended, we also have ambulance services, and maybe I'm just a little confused about what's a regional policy versus what's an individual ambulance policy and how they network together and how it interacts with the other requirements on people making choices about where is the most appropriate medical care. And because it looks like you could have a regional policy that might be different than an individual ambulance provider. And if you could just help me understand what's the coordination and the fact that it all matches up and people know what to do when something happens somewhere.
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. In Minnesota, every ambulance service that's licensed is required to have a medical director. The 8 regional EMS programs we talked about last week, shifting those to MDH, those coordinate regional first responders. So the idea of why we added the amendment was to be sure the 300-plus licensed ambulance services were all required to have those protocols to make sure, like trauma patients and cardiac patients, we get them to the right facility based off some signs and symptoms that the ambulance attendant sees when they pick them up, and some simple things that they do to decide we should go from Brainerd right to St. Joe's and St. Paul because we need to coil them and have them come out better. And the 8 regional programs also even walk that down farther and make sure the first responders understand that and they coordinate at the local level that they might provide a template standard operating procedure that all the ambulance services can use.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up to that, just a simple, will they be totally coordinated and identical, or will there be some tension points potentially? And how does this fit with the existing law that deals with protocols for deciding when you move someone to a different level of care?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. Not unlike our trauma protocols that we use. Surprisingly, in the entire state, the majority of the EMS system uses protocols called the West Metro or East Metro protocols that are really designed by, surprisingly, there's about 4 or 5 medical directors across the entire state that really provide some of those protocols that are vetted out with the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board's Physician Advisory Committee. So many of those are very standard in what we do. There is some deviation, and that's always the authority of the local medical director. If I'm a physician in Browns Valley, it might be better for me to send patients across the border into the Dakotas than it is to have them come down to the cities. So there is some unique adjustments based off your geographic location, whether that's trauma, cardiac, or something like stroke that we're talking about here today. But overall today, our protocols are pretty much very standard, and what our state EMS board posts on the website as template protocols are one many of our rural systems use.
Representative Loeffler.
And thank you, Madam Chair. The other question I would just have is, has the Department of Health and its people who work on this on a statewide policy bill been involved and supportive, if you know?
Yep.
If you could introduce yourself.
Sure. Thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Justin Bell. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association here in Minnesota. And Representative Loeffler, yes, we've been working in concert with the Department of Health and our Stroke Advisory Committee that's sort of authorized us and advised us on each step of this along the way.
Thank you very much.
Question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McAlpin, is this different? A few years ago, I was attending Towards Zero Death, and there's a lot of discussion of this, plus the local first responders and others were implementing. Has this changed, or is it this just an effort because some areas were slow in adapting?
Madam Chair.
Mr. McAlpin.
Representative Quam. I don't know if slow and adapting was just more of a term, Representative Quam, except more standardization of the protocols. But it was the same discussion we've had for years around standardizing stroke protocols. I think trauma, I think flashy is probably the wrong word to use, but we see that in the news a lot. We see bad car wrecks. We see things that happen. That's just visible. Cardiac and stroke have now come along as we see a lot more of those type of patients than, knock on wood, we see critical car accidents and just also very time-sensitive stuff. But our data shows unbelievable outcomes if we remind and train our crews a little bit differently to recognize it and move them rapidly.
Representative Quam. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And first of all, I thank you, Representative Zerwas, for carrying this. I think it's really important stuff. But as I'm sitting here, I'm just kind of wondering if everybody has, or if the law now tells everybody they have to have a protocol. Is there some liability created if they create a protocol that's inadequate, or you know, if somebody doesn't follow their protocol and then there's some bad outcome from that? Is there any liability created by this?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Representative, there's always liability in this business, like anything that we do, but we feel better that we actually have less liability by having some very organized, and we don't call them standard operating procedures. I might have even stated that wrong, as much as guidelines. These are guidelines our medical directors sign off to follow, because every patient might present a little bit differently. And what we think is a stroke could just be somebody having a little Bell's palsy for the day in their face, but they still get treated overly than underly and taken to the right facility. But we'd rather have some standardized guidelines out there for our providers that are approved by our medical directors. Everything's the ultimate. That's one thing I've always liked about Minnesota's EMS system. Very, very physician-driven. And this is another example that everything goes to the physician to be credentialed.
Representative Liebling.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't disagree with that. I assume that there isn't any opposition to this from any of the folks that are going to be, because you know what you're saying is great, except what we're doing here is putting it in law that it's required. So that's just kind of what I'm asking about. And again, I don't think that's a bad thing, but you know, somebody might. Does anybody think that's a bad thing?
Mr. Bell.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, this has put the third part of the stroke system that we've been unveiling, and we've been vetting this language and talking about this to all the participants and stakeholders for several years. This particular language has been passing out and seeking input in for over a year with all the stakeholders, and as of today, we haven't heard any opposition to it. We've certainly taken some criticism and used that in the language and taken some direction one way or another, and what we have in front of us seems to be what everybody's on board with.
Thank you.
Well, and that leads, and we don't have anyone else with questions right now, but is there anyone else from the audience who wants to testify or comment on the bill? Any further discussion from members? Okay, seeing none, Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 513 as amended be sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas has House File 523, adding an additional accrediting organization for ambulatory health care. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You can move your bill also, Representative Zerwas.
Yes, I will move House File 523. I think this one goes to the General Register as well.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 523 to be passed to the General Register. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The accreditation of the Association for Ambulatory Health Care is a private, nonprofit organization that was formed in 1979. The organization was nice enough to provide someone to give some a little bit more background on what we're accomplishing here today. But my understanding is that they're having some issues with seven states that currently in law don't recognize the AAAAHC as an accrediting organization. It's actually the largest accrediting organization for ambulatory health care in the country. And so we're trying to rectify that situation, not just here, but in several other states. We have a letter that I think was made available in your packet from the Ambulatory Surgery Center from Minnesota in support of the bill. And for further explanation for the organization, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Ms. Carrera, if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm Ann Carrera, and I'm the staff attorney for Legislative Affairs for the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, also known as AAAHC, here today in support of HB 523. The Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, AAAHC, as Representative Zaroa said, is a private nonprofit organization. We've been in business for over 35 years. AAAHC currently accredits over 6,000 organizations in a wide variety of ambulatory health care settings, including ambulatory surgery centers, community health centers, medical and dental group practices, medical home practices, managed care organizations, HMOs, as well as Indian and student health centers, many in Minnesota. The AAAHC is also the official accrediting organization for the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Coast Guard for their ambulatory health clinics. While AAAHC accredits over 80 healthcare organizations in Minnesota, we are not listed in Minnesota statute as a nationally recognized independent organization, which is required in Minnesota to be able to accredit certain types of healthcare organizations. Our understanding is that this omission wasn't anything deliberate. It was just that AAAHC didn't reach out to legislature when the statute was being drafted. And so it's really more of like a technical fix to include AAAHC in the statute. So now that AAAHC is the largest ambulatory healthcare accrediting organization in the country, we are reaching out to the seven states where AAAHC is not named in the statutes. So by adding AAAHC to the statute, it provides another option to the healthcare organizations who are seeking accreditation. It also would allow any organizations that are already accredited by AAAHC seeking to do business in Minnesota to have that accreditation recognized as well. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay, we have a question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we pay a lot of money to have a lot of experts in our state agencies, and they really have to know and oversee these accreditation things. And I'm wondering whether or not the Commissioner of Health and the Commissioner of Commerce or their appropriate staff have reviewed this and recommend this and say that the standards are the same. I just don't see anyone from the health plan group that would be regulated by this or any of the regulatory agencies actually commenting on this. So I'm a little concerned about sending it to the general register without really understanding if these are the same standards, lower, higher than what we're currently using. And if, you know, maybe the author could address that. And in the future, it'd be really nice if we had letters if they actually are supporting these things for us to know before we send something to the floor.
Yeah, and I don't see anyone representing the department here today. I'm assuming they're following our agendas and what's coming, so would be here if they felt it necessary. But Ms. Carrera or Representative Zerwas to that point. Representative Zerwas.
Yeah, Madam Chair, nobody from the Department of Health has contacted me with any concerns. This is introduced quite a while back and haven't had any concerns whatsoever. I know that the statewide ambulatory clinician group has expressed support for this. I've had no contact from anyone that's raised any concerns whatsoever.
Okay, and Representative Loeffler, I do see Ms. Finnegan coming forward from the department.
Great.
Thanks for coming. I'm sorry, I didn't see you over there. But if you can introduce yourself and if you want to speak to this issue.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Melissa Finnegan. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. No one in my staff has flagged this bill for me as having any concerns. I have not heard any commentary on it from within the department. So at the moment, I would say that the department is neutral on this legislation.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, I would just really ask for you to get an official position because they may or may not have even looked at it by not having contacted Ms. Finnegan. And I'm not sure that you can always assume that the Commerce Department looks at Health and Human Services agendas. We have some shared responsibilities here. And I'm not opposed to, you know, your organization at all, Ms. Kerr. I just don't feel like I have the background to know. Is it stronger, weaker, the exact same as what we currently are using? And I just feel like that's useful information.
Ms. Finnegan. Or, sorry, Representative Zerwas, who wants to respond to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I can certainly reach out to the departments before this is taken up on the floor.
Appreciate it. Any further questions or comments? Or anyone from the audience who wants to speak to the bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 523 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Members, that concludes our business for the day, and so our next meeting will be tomorrow at 2:45. We will see you then, and we are adjourned.
Aye.